Hello, all of you. Thanks for coming. I'm William O'Rourke. I'll introduce myself after I introduce the two people to my right. This is Navigating the Other 60s, the publishing world and the post-60 writer, which I brought about. So I act as the moderator, but I will also begin and say a few things more or less to set a context for the remarks to come. And then after the three of us say what we're going to say, we'll respond to each other if we want, and then take questions from the audience. And the questions from the audience are important in this particular kind of setting, insofar as you might think from what I'm going to say and the personnel sitting up here that you're already victims of two kinds of bait and switch, insofar as I will first introduce Valerie Sayers, who will come on in some virtual reality slash theatrical presence, insofar as Susan Ramsey is sitting at the end of the table, because Valerie Sayers had difficulties with the weather in South Bend, Indiana, where, and a sign of the times, and we'll probably get to this later, she is not only in the creative writing side of the English department, she is also chair of the entire English department. Valerie couldn't make it, so she had a prepared text, because Valerie is always prepared, and it was faxed out here, and Susan has agreed to read it. Now, Susan is no slouch. Valerie, if you happen to see the card, I'll just read what it says here. Valerie Sayers is the author of 6 novels, Due East being the first, and that and how I went back, was made into a film that was released, I don't know, 7-8 years ago on Mother's Day. But Valerie is part of the other 1% these days, meaning she's of the 1% of fiction writers whose entire backlist is in print, because Northwestern University Press, another sign of the times, brought out her new novel, The Powers, which came out last year, and then this fall they brought out her backlist. So that's a rare distinction these days. It's not the same as being the 1% we all know about, alas, but nonetheless it's still a 1%. But as I said, Susan's no slouch. She won the Prairie Schooner Prize a year ago for the poetry called A Mind Like This. Susan is also a graduate of our Notre Dame MFA program. Now, I don't understand what control, I know it might be some psychic thing of the Midwest, we have over the Prairie Schooner Prize. I don't know any of the people at Nebraska, but Susan won it 2 years ago. I mean, it came out 2 years ago. This year, the winner was Orlando Menez, who is also at Notre Dame, so we exert some mysterious influence over Nebraska for some reason. Happy that I and we exert influence over something. So, no Valerie, but we will have her words. Sitting to my immediate right is David Matlin. David is any number of things, poet, nonfiction writer, fiction writer, novelist, short story writer. His most recent book is Up Fish Creek Road. It's a collection of short stories that's just come out a couple of years ago. Come right in, don't hesitate. A couple of years ago, he published a novel, the second of a trilogy called Half Man Dreaming, along with other books, a work that got republished and enlarged on the American prison system, which is one of those underreported catastrophes in the United States. So the way this is going to go is I will start to talk a little bit more coherently, though it's not a paper. I've been to a number of panels this time at this AWP, and people get up and read papers. It's funny because part of my pitch will be how the AWP now constitutes numbers and the rest, that they are the rival to the MLA, where, of course, you do present academic papers. But these are just talks. I still see this as talks rather than presenting papers or this sort of thing. The MLA is still primarily a hiring event for PhDs, and all the papers they deliver is a further hiring event insofar as the MLA functions as a kind of production line for scholars to, one hopes, for the individual scholars to be promoted or retained for another, you know, 3 years or until they get the transformative state of tenure. Okay, let me begin. As John Leonard once wrote in a review of my, oh, I didn't introduce myself, so you probably, most of you probably don't have a clue of who I am. Not that it matters. I'm William O'Rourke. I published my first book when I was a little kid. I was 26. It was called The Harrisburg Seven and the New Catholic Left. It's an account of the last of the Nixon era anti-Vietnam War conspiracy trials. It was on the New York Times New and Recommended for 6 weeks, one of the best books of the year. But my joke at the time was I wouldn't have read it had I not written it. It was what they call, alas, a success of esteem. But it got a lot of attention, which at 26 I thought that's just what happens. You publish a good book and everybody pays attention. Then I learned differently as time went on. I've published 4 novels, 5 other works of nonfiction, edited a couple of books. I founded the creative writing program at Notre Dame, etc. Okay. As John Leonard once wrote in a review of my 1981 novel, Idle Hands, I can make the obvious more clear. It's more or less what I intend to do here today. One of the first things to note is that our generation, and I'm speaking to my generation, I'm 68, I was born in 1945 in December. The baby boom actually starts in January of 46, but I was like premature. Though I was 9 months, you know, whatever, but I was for the baby boom. Those of us of our generation of a certain age, we were the first incline of the bulging baby boom to come. Its apex was 57. Some of you probably know that. Are having a singular generational experience. In other words, we are unique. Now, most every generation claims such a thing. Everybody wants to have a purchase on singularity. But given my own history and numerous accounts by historians and writers of all sorts, this claim appears to be true. Nobody, especially writers, who are, if you even go with the stereotype of the past, very individualistic, non-conforming, whatever other phrases you want to attach to it, always has a problem when they discover they're actually one part of a cohort, just one small number of many similar things. We, of course, rode a demographic wave of none of our doing. The baby boom, I suppose our parents participated in it in some fashion, but we just rode the wave of it. We just went along with the tripling of the number of students in higher education. This has always been a fascinating for me number, because I noticed this back in the late 70s, that, because I don't know how I encountered it, I just encounter a lot of things, but I saw that during the 1960s, the number of individuals in higher education tripled during the 1960s. Now, higher education was counted any form of college. What was startling was how constant the number had been previous to the 60s. Even the GI Bill, where, you know, everybody has the impression, you know, all the, you know, a very small percentage of the soldiers actually really did go into college, but the kind of myth is, oh, every GI became a college student when they got back, which of course wasn't true. But even that number injected into higher education was just a minor blip. It really almost never doubled. College, I don't want to go into the history of, you know, academic institutions, some of you might know it, but it's just startling. So we had the 60s where everything tripled. And if you triple the number of people in higher education, guess what happens? I'll tell you in a minute. I published my first novel a couple of years after the Harrisburg book in 1974, and it was called The Meekness of Isaac. It was about, you know, one kid who went to Vietnam and one kid who was trying to stay out of the army, doing all he could do to do that. That year, and another constant number in 74, was only roughly around 100 first novels were published. And that was, the Library Journal used to keep these statistics. Over 90% of those first novels that were published by commercial presses, as mine was. So what happens, though, when you triple the number of people in higher education? In another decade or so, the number shot up to 300 novels a year. And that growth started to become rather exponential. And the ratio of commercial publishing to non-commercial publishing began to adjust. Okay. But even though the 60s, 1960s, educated so many, hardly no one, I only knew of one young writer back then in 68 when I was at Columbia University. They just had started their graduate writing program. There was only 20 of us then. Back then, Columbia didn't use their MFA program as a cash cow, which they use it now as a cash cow. But back then, there's only 20 of us there, 10 poets, 10 fiction writers. I only knew when we were graduating 2 years later, only one of the cohort of 20 wanted to get an academic job. I was startled that he wanted to get an academic job, because what came to mind was, how? What are you qualified? Why are you qualified to go teach in a college or university? It just seemed madness to me. If you want to know who it was Lee Siegel. Anyway, Lee, from California, and he ended up getting a job. I think at the University of Oregon or something. God knows what he was teaching. Some of us took literature courses at Columbia. Others, you could just pick whatever you wanted. Lee took a course in anatomy and dissection at the medical school. They let him do that. I doubt if they'd let him do that today. And he earned his keep in that course by sketching the bodies as they were deconstructed. And Lee is a talented artist, too. Besides, he finally started to publish novels when he got into his 30s and 40s. I guess all that early teaching impeded him. But what our generation did run into was a gathering storm of perception. We, again, didn't have to do it, anything with that. That students at universities throughout the land couldn't write. I never remembered in the 60s any golden age of teenage writing. I never thought my kids I was in high school with could write very well. I could write, but I was the exception, as were most writers who actually happened into college in all the decades before. The fact that students didn't write well wasn't news. So I was surprised when everybody thought this was a big problem out there. For young writers such as myself, for me, I thought it just cut down the competition. So I was happy they couldn't write. It seemed to be good for everybody. But during the 70s and 80s, the growth period of creative writing programs across the land occurred. In the middle of the 70s, I mean, at the end of the 60s, it was only a dozen or two. By the middle of the 70s, it was still in the double digits, the number of creative writing programs. In order to get hired, you had to have a book or two already published, because that was the older model. The few universities and colleges that kept writers on the staff were usually writers of a more elderly sort towards the end of their careers. They would come on as writers in residence. They would have a kind of tutorial relationship with, but they were nothing like academics. Nothing like academics at all. But the MFA thing, as it grew in numbers, and these jobs at universities became open, having an MFA played a very particular role, along with having a book or two published, because that meant you were gelded. Meaning, I don't know if there's a gender-neutral word for this, but you know, you were sterilized in some fashion, that you weren't going to be a wild man or woman in the department, because you've already had some taste of academic life at a graduate level, like all the other professors in the institutions. So the numbers of creative writing programs just, you know, skyrocketed. George Garrett and a few others started the AWP, I think it was in 69, 70. You know, it was a kind of gathering of, like, they were, again, some of them were the older generation that had hung on for more than a year or two at a place, and then, you know, started to teach creative writing. Here today, you know, going from the numbers in 60s and the 70s to what brings us all here today at the AWP, thousands of people. And what happens, you know, to the writers? Again, I don't know about you, most of you are somewhere in shouting distance of my age. The wanting to be in academia, it was like, well, you can teach or not teach during that growth period where it didn't take much to get hired. The idea is, you sort of, there was always ambivalence about being a writer and artist and teaching at the same time. Whereas the PhDs didn't have any of that ambivalence. That's what they wanted to do. And there were any number of PhDs who were also like poets on the side and did, you know, creative writing. And there was a kind of, the writers became over the decades more acclimated, the PhDs, some of them began to do more writing because all of a sudden this new crop of people were coming in and made it okay to do that. Everything started to adjust. But I don't know about you, but it's always the weird thing when you set out to be a writer and what it meant in my formative years, and you end up turning or becoming part of a business. The AWP is a trade association. My father, God bless him, died a couple years ago, he sold bearings and was the head of the purchasing agent association, trade association. And do you think he went off to work every day wearing his suit? And none of that I wanted to do. It's an odd thing to think that I'm now a member of a trade association, the way he was the member of a trade association. Okay, as in academia, publishing has gone through its own form of creative destruction over the years, beginning more forcefully in the 1980s. It has to do with the reinvention of the trade paperback, taking over literary fiction, all sorts of stuff going on, talk about later. The old saw in my youth was everybody had one book in them. That's what I used to hear in the 50s, 60s, growing up. Everybody has one book in them. Well, right now, everyone has one publisher in them. And you can publish. Now, as this phenomena of creative writing in higher education grew and grew and grew, you needed something to support that whole mechanism. What happened is coterie publishing started. And you can always blame it on Virginia Woolf, who had her own press and published her friends, all those poets that she knew. And so if Virginia Woolf could do it, why can't we do it? Because that's what happens. So coterie publishing has picked up the slack. Commercial publishing has run as far as it could away from most of this. The original fiction collective, which started in the early 70s, was the phenomenon where Steve Katz and a number of other people whose first books would publish by commercial presses, they wrote a second book. All of a sudden the commercial presses said, oh no. And this was even before BookScan, where now publishers know exactly how many copies you sell. You could always fudge the numbers early on in the 70s and 80s, but not now. Okay, I can go on in this vein, but I won't because I'm already taking up time. There's one other answer. This is a very large phenomenon, and we are just part of it. Another ancillary proof of this is Westbeth. I don't know if any of you know Westbeth in New York City. It's this old building, I think GE owned it, huge cement fortress. It's a train tracks coming into it, or used to, because it made war material, a lot of electrical components for all sorts of things during World War II. In the 60s, it sat vacant. The train tracks decayed. Train tracks have now become the very chic High Line. But nonetheless, they turned it over to young artists. Okay, move in. We're going to establish cheaper housing for artists, that painters, musicians, writers, whatever. I put my name in the 1970s just because I thought, hey, I barely published anything. It was before the book. And anyway, make a long story short, the federal government now considers Westbeth a NORC. That's what the federal government calls it. And it's now under all sorts of legal protection because part of it was paid for with a HUD loan, four decades ago. It's a NORC, N-O-R-C, a naturally occurring retirement community. In other words, it's an old folks home. I give you Susan Ramsey, who will read. She doesn't qualify for the panel, but anyway, Susan Ramsey, 60. Yeah, so. If you want to admit it.
William was saying we all feel we have a purchase on singularity. Well, I was in college from 68 to 72, which is, of course, when the 60s really were. So we're the singular of the singular. Yeah. I am. Please imagine that I'm Valerie Sayers because it will make me very happy. I wish I were Valerie Sayers. She allowed a poet to take her fiction workshop, and I was embarrassingly horrible, but it was just because I wanted to hang around Valerie Sayers for two quarters. Anyone in the room, by the way, who is under 60 gets double karma today. This is very wise of you, because with any luck at all, you're going to get here, though you missed the real good 60s. Of course, one thing about the 60s was that the status of women began to bubble. When you were talking about the writers in residence, they all wore ties. I didn't even notice there were no women on my faculty the English an English faculty with no women in the 60s, and it was a good little liberal arts college. So Valerie has, thanks to the miracles of facts, been able to send us her 60s list, and it is her 86 theses, and I'm the hammer. So, and if you would hand me the glasses, because I'm in my 60s. Thank you. We're good now. I am now Valerie. There we go. Never. Besides that, I taught 6-hour study hall my first year of teaching. I could, without the microphone, make it back there, but yes. A 60s list. This is my story, but it sounds a lot like the stories of many writers of my generation, so I offer it in solidarity, or comfort, or contrast. Another writer's story. 2. I've written it as a list because I've lived by lists. A beautiful and economical form that makes you feel briefly in charge of things. The requirement of a writing life, giving the self over to a kind of abandonment, makes any kind of control look attractive. 3. As a woman writer coming along in the 60s and 70s, educated in a public high school in the South and a Catholic university in New York City, I certainly felt out of control. I was possessed of a serious literary inferiority complex. 4. However, 5. I had a distinct advantage. I was blessedly unburdened by the need I saw all around me to rank and sort writers. One morning I saw Norman Mailer on TV railing about who was the greater writer, Norman Mailer or Philip Roth. I think he said Roth, but maybe he said Bellow or Cheever or some other white dude he thought he could take. And I thought, at least I don't have to carry that god-awful sack of stones. 6. The need to name the great American novel and the great American writer and the great American canon and the 100 best books used to be primarily, though not exclusively, a white male of privilege syndrome. Now it's a global epidemic. 7. But women of the 60s and 70s were the children of Tilly Olson's silences, struggling to write a page or two, much less the great American novel, believers in economic circumstances and luck, and especially time as factors that let writers write. 8. And while that was discouraging, because I lacked money and luck and time, it was also, 9, it was also strangely liberating to recognize the struggle in those who shared it. 10. Besides, as a woman, I was also raised on the legend of the kitchen table. And even though I didn't actually have a kitchen table, I kept an image of myself writing at that table while the baby slept and while the children were in school and after they grew up and once earning a living was done. 11. It never occurred to me, no matter how many interruptions, that I would ever start writing, stop writing unto old age. 12. Or that I would fret over whether I would ever be thought the greatest living American writer. 13. When I was a young writer, I had bigger worries. 14. It often occurred to me that I might not ever publish or even be read. 15. If I did publish, I was a good child of the counterculture and I would publish at a small alternative press. 16. I'll admit I hedged my bets. I sent my work out to all the little magazines and Cosmip's old paperback listing and, guiltily, to the New Yorker and the Atlantic. 17. I endured a spectacular number of rejections, which became encouraging rejections, and finally in my 30s and 40s, before I graded the papers and while the babies slept, voila, a modest literary success. 18. I acquired a big New York publisher, and I got reviewed in the New York Times and all over the country because those were the days when the Anniston Star and the South Bend Tribune had good book review sections that took on all kinds of novels and gave them 800 words, often quite generous and thoughtful. 19. I got myself a big name agent and a bit of a swollen head. I was paid advances that were a little too small to pay a New York rent and way too big to last. 20. I published 5 novels with the same publisher, 4 with the same editor, who, wouldn't you know, was smart enough to leave publishing. 21. To write her own novel. 22. I had tons of interviews conducted by airheads who hadn't read the book, and I had book tours to 16 cities that left me feeling cheap and inadequate and a betrayer of my art. I had a New York writer's life. 23. After the magical editor who brought me this writer's life left, my new editor canceled lunches and spelled my name wrong on her exceedingly brief correspondence. 24. So when my 5th novel, perhaps not uncoincidentally on the subject of a middle-aged man's mental breakdown, appeared in the catalog with no mention of tours or interviews or advertising, but rather a cheerful, free freight, I knew it was over. 25. Oh well, I'd seen the ink disappearing on those corporate publishing contracts for years. 26. I got myself a teaching job, which unbeknownst to me, involved administration and 12-hour days. 27. And I kept getting breaks. Someone made a movie of my first two novels, which put my son through college and housed the other. 28. In the Tilly Olson scheme of things, I was lucky, 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 and didn't know it. I was completely optimistic about the future. 29. I finished two new novels, one right after another, and one right after the other. New editors embraced them. 30. But their publishers refused to go along. They saw my old advances and the nefarious book scan evidence. They could read a bottom line. 31. So I pulled those novels back to fuss with them because, after all, they were a little odd and certainly not destined for commercial glory. 32. But it never occurred to me to stop writing. 33. In the midst of this publishing limbo, I got cancer and I got scared. 34. Publishing seemed trivial. 35. When I got through my cancer scare, writing in the state I'd started in with no hope of publication whatsoever sounded just about right. 36. I decided to zen it, and I went on a short story bender. 37. Not that I hadn't written stories. I had a lifetime of writing failed stories and brilliant in flashes stories. Now I wanted to write good stories, perfect stories, stories whose very periods would pierce Isaac Babel's heart. 38. And face it. Even those convinced they're living in the refound moment need a periodic hit of good publishing news. If the plan was to wait out the novel publishers, I'd have to see shorter works in print. 39. So for years, I published scores of stories and essays and reviews. 40. I still felt like a writer because I still was a writer, but I was also living a secret life of a novelist. 41. I fiddled with the novels I hadn't placed, and I started another, and then, simultaneously, another. 42. I didn't care if I ever published them, and I cared desperately. 43. I had half-finished novels stockpiled on my computer, my desk, my floor, and boy, can I recognize a crisis of confidence when I see one. 44. So I bore down hard on the one that was going to be my elegant tour de force, The Powers, about Joe DiMaggio and pacifism and photography. 45. And around the time I was close to finishing, in the middle of one frustrating and endless academic day, a little gift popped up in my inbox. 46. An email from Henry Kerrigan of Northwestern University Press, who wanted to reprint my first five novels. 48. Here I was, 30 years later, finally matched with my alternative small press publisher. 49. Smallish, alternative-ish. More important, a press I'd admired for years. 50. I'd never gone anywhere, but somehow I felt I was back. 51. And in the outpouring of generous responses to that novel, and just not just from reviewers and booksellers, though Northwestern came through with those, but especially in the emails and notes and letters from long-lost friends and strangers, I relocated some 60s principles. 52. Literature may be written in the loneliest and most magnificent of solitudes, but its entry into the world is a communal venture. 53. When most of the New York publishers decided, at the behest of their corporate conglomerate masters, that the profit margin for a single title was more important than building a writer's relationship a title at a time, when they decided that they weren't going to take those chances anymore, even if they had Danielle Steele on the list to pay for a little risky living, they betrayed a whole generation of writers. 54. This generation. 55. Screw them. 56. What irony that this generation, who may now be looking into the corporate maw of assisted living, once had assisted publishing. 56. Now, 57. Now we, well, I, am finally learning to do what poets and many of the prose writers at this conference have known for a long time. 58. We get by with a little help from our friends. 59. And much as I believe the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world are capitalist seducers who have invented tacky and juvenile jargon to demean charming, intelligent, and lovely people who only want to connect with their friends. 60. I'm ready for the geezer writers to occupy, if not Facebook, whatever strikes our fancy, the thousands, the millions of collectivist sites and apps and networks to come. 61. And while we're occupying the new electronic encampments, let's don't neglect the hand letter presses and the binders and the book artists who cherish the medium and have long since stopped thinking for 1 minute about mass markets and tweets. 62. Or the university presses that came to my rescue and are under terrible pressure to earn out. And all the other small, medium, and gonzo alternative presses that have hung on all these years and spring up as I speak. 63. Some of us have been smart enough to live our entire lives in collective endeavor. All we had to do is walk down to the book fair to see this history. But others of us need to move back to that youthful 60s ideal of power of the small and the local. Reaching one book buyer at a time is inextricably connected to what it is we do. One writer speaking to one reader at a time. 64. As the generation behind us wrests control of the means of critical production and joyfully downsizes and disperses publishing, we're all back to hawking one book at a time, and though there's nothing I'd rather do less than sell, except maybe administer, there's selling and there's selling. It seems to me there's some real delight to be had in the assault on the big profit publishing. Let them eat Danielle Steele. 65. Sure, I still put myself to sleep with fantasies of the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. 67. And yes, if I were offered another big advance, I'd know what it meant. A writer will do most anything to buy more writing time, and the New York publishing world is still filled with smart, good editors. 68. But this time, I'd think real hard about it. 69. Easy for me to say. I'm one of the lucky ones who had the advances, who got the job. 70. I'll get to retire one of these years, soon, I hope, and reclaim a full life of writing. 71. I'll finally be the writer who can afford to write, the Tilly Olson writer, unsilenced, big time. 72. Watch out. 73. Those of us in our 60s belong to a politically committed generation with a lifetime of reading and writing behind us. 74. I find myself writing to that aging readership now, and I find myself writing gleefully about the aged and the young and whatever and whomever I feel writing about. 75. I am setting my work in an anti-nostalgic past and a terrifyingly rising water future, and I often find myself feeling blessedly unhinged sitting at that kitchen table, which still doesn't actually exist. 76. I realize that my subjects and my history may not be sexy to a hot young editor 5 years out of Bryn Mawr or Amherst, but maybe they're sexy to a whole generation of folk who sustained me. 77. And to all kinds of younger readers who are willing to cut their own paths. 78. It's no use tasting bile, feeling neglected, romanticizing any past, much less a publishing past. 79. No use and no fun. 80. Writing well is ever and always, unto old age, the best revenge and the sweetest satisfaction. 81. And having machines to crank out the type. 82. Not to mention a whole new publishing world springing up online. 83 isn't such a bad bargain either. 84. My list is coming to 86 items, and since 86 is not nearly as many years as I mean to live, let's just say to be continued. 85. Whatever happens to publishing, and whatever happens to my own ability to publish, I'm glad to be back to a point, most days, when the publishing isn't the point, the writing is the point. 86. And it doesn't occur to me, it can't occur to me, that I might stop writing, because then I really might curl up and die.
Thanks, Susan. I'm sure Valerie will thank you. David Matlin.
Can you hear me? Yeah. I came to a lifetime of writing by a really odd means, at least myself, self even to this day. I had a terrible learning disability as a child, and my parents, because I was such a tricky kid, they didn't know that I couldn't read until I was at least 9 or 10 years old. And when that was discovered, my mother dedicated at least 2 or 3 years of her life to this other very interesting woman, teaching me how to read. And I was very self-conscious about the act of writing or the act of reading, though I grew up in a house where there were many artists in life. And when I first began to think about what it might mean to be an artist, having seen a number of examples, I wanted to be a painter.
And in the midst of those first desires and those first attempts at painting, I realized that it was going to be writing, and it really threw me into a kind of crisis. And in the midst of this crisis, I remember there was an advertisement in a small desert town that I grew up in Southern California, of a series of porn movies that another young potential artist was going to show in a little town called Cucamonga, California. So me and a couple of friends who were really interested in being hot rodders and all kinds of other things went to these porn movies, and it turns out that the filmmaker of these porn films was Frank Zappa, who originally founded the Mothers of Invention, and there he was playing his drums in this little community hall in Cucamonga, California. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And I never took a creative writing course, because when I was a kid at that point, there was no such thing as a creative writing course. You more or less had to try to figure it out for yourself. And a number of years later, because I don't want to go through a whole autobiography here, I was working in a very dangerous foundry in Berkeley, California, and went over to San Francisco State University and just on a lark turned a series of beginning writings into this man named Robert Creeley, and he told me to come back in about 3 weeks or a month later, which I did. And we sat down and had a very interesting conversation, because I had turned him in a kind of pile of chaos. For some reason, he loved it and said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I won't have time to read, man. I've never really had time to read. I've had to work. I was a construction worker. I've hitchhiked. I've been in jail. All kinds of things." And they gave me a scholarship to what was then called the State University of New York at Buffalo. So I looked it up, because I didn't know anything about this, and there were people there like Robert Creeley who were teaching, and John Barth and Jorge Luis Borges, and they gave me a complete fellowship. I didn't have a bachelor's degree, I didn't have nothing, and they took an incredible chance. And I suppose from that point onward I've been living on that chance and taking it as far as I could go. I walked in from having moved from Berkeley, California, and my first graduate seminar was with John Barth, and it was terrific. And they told me when I came in, all of these people, that they didn't care what I wrote or if I wrote during that period of time that I was at Buffalo. What they cared more about at that moment for me and for all of the others who were then graduate students in that program, is how we cast ourselves and attempted to find an imagination of what it was we were reading. And on the basis of that quality of possibilities, I have felt ever since that that the major issue in any of these so-called creative writing programs probably isn't the writing itself, but how one educates one's imagination. And I always think that that's really the major issue in terms of any of these processes. If it's really not involved in educating the imagination, then there's really no sustaining resource that one can come to. I've always felt that that was always the major issue in terms of how one reads. And they were really interested with Creeley and others, because they were such incredibly interesting and wonderful monsters. I remember I would have these courses. Nobody would say a thing to me. And then at 4 o'clock in the morning in a bar, suddenly people like Robert Creeley would sober up and start asking you questions about what you were doing, what you were thinking, what you were reading, what you were imagining, what you were dreaming. And the quality of that interest and the sense of how to articulate that interest at a point when you didn't think you were capable of it provided a sense of how one, I suppose, gains one's nerve before what you're doing, and how to discover what that nerve and courage might be. And if if one doesn't have mentors like this, I think you really get lost and won't be able to sustain what it means to be able to attempt to make an art for one's own lifetime. And that, you know, that propelled me into, you know, to a lot of possibilities. And one of those possibilities for myself, because I couldn't get a job, and I was, you know, not dissimilar to William over here on my left, to teach and to go into a university was really the last thing on my mind. I couldn't have conceived of any of that. More what I could have conceived of was being a construction worker for the most part, and trying to make my way into the world, because I thought always, and still do on many, on many levels, that if you teach, it propels you into responsibilities that have nothing to do with the actual writing itself. And I've always found that very difficult, though at a very late age I did get a job in a university. But I think again that, and leave it open to you guys and to whatever questions you might have, that the most important part of whatever these programs are, and they often don't even think about this, is really how to educate one's own imagination and how to, in that process, discover that reading is an art that you must make up out of your own individual peculiarities and out of those peculiarities really move forward with as much nerve as you can find and courage as you can find in yourself and see what will happen. And I'll leave it up to the audience now.
Okay, are there any specific questions? Yes?
I wanted to ask a question about what I call the anxiety, but the anxiety of age. As I walk around the home, so I see a thinking adult, a lot fewer white heads, I think the population was a New Yorker. So when you see people tend not to listen, I see the old guy in the room, and it's an old guy, but so they don't see associated for aging writers. In other words, is there a sense of anxiety about publishing, continuing to write, continuing to appear, and the editors of the publishing?
Yeah, I think we can all take a shot at that after, and I'll start because I'm standing here. I think that is an important question because it goes back to
an extraordinary joy over what it is doing. And I, you know, when I think of artists into their old age who continue to paint or continue to attempt to imagine the possibility of what it would mean to make an art, I can remember Ron Sukinek, who was an old friend who got really very, very ill at the end of his life, and his body locked up on him. He became completely paralyzed and finally suffocated to death because of that paralysis. He wrote his most beautiful work through the worst periods of this disease that he was undergoing, and was an incredibly brave man. And to see people moving toward old age, whether they're artists or not, and having courage, I think provides us all with the possibility of wonder and a sense of deep reassurance in relationship to whatever this sense of aging might be. And does the imagination die? I don't think so. You know, the longer you live, the more enriched this possibility becomes. And if you, you know, found yourself in the daily process of attempting to make art, I think that, you know, given what happens to all of us at certain points, you have a chance perhaps to come into the finest work that you could have ever imagined yourself writing or making as you become older. And though there are many things to fear, you, with all of these memories, with all of this life having been lived, have more courage on some levels. There's many more doubts, there's many more difficulties, but it's actually one of the wonders, I think. And I think in my own experience, I've found that what I'm writing now has a much much more multiplicity to it, and is offering me challenges that I could have never thought possible as a younger man. Yes? Please.
I think of a couple of memoirs, whether they illustrate
or not. Can you
speak up?
Okay. Stand up.
The memoirs, whether they were ghostwritten or they were written by themselves, Colin Powell and Robert Gates,
mm-hmm.
and they were both, they were written in the 90s as if they were older men looking back on the past. But as we know, they went on to become, well, one of the most famous students for
Roger Angelos, who we're citing, is in his 90s. So to those of us in our 60s, this is like 30-year-old getting us as old, you know. He can feel it a little less.
Yeah, there's three of you. Why don't you just start asking questions, and after enough of you ask things, we'll respond a bit more. Oh, you got cut off? I thought you had...
And I sort of represent a different angle of this since, well, poets... I have never had to worry too much about great success early on or the rest of the way through. But when you were talking about the effect, the growing fears on this, on one hand, you know, the experience of aging beats the alternative a whole lot. But I confess that I have feared outgrowing my editors. When you find, you know, your great dream is to find a journal that you like, and if it's David Wagner's Poetry Northwest, first the journal outlives you, and then Richard Jones at Poetry Eats, you know, you start looking at this. But I think that going back to what Valerie was saying about the communal feeling of the 60s, that poetry is a big house, literature is a big house, and everybody in their broom closet feels that they're the only real carriers of words. But if you can find your broom closet, that tends to be more of a vertical thing. If you can find the young editors who happen to like the same flavor that you do, if you can find a cohort of writers who resonate on the same frequency that you do, it builds courage. You can kind of link elbows together and find ways of building your faith in your writing and finding ways of getting it to somebody else who can read it that are liable to pay off better. Okay, sorry, take that.
You
and
those.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about what you gain from your teaching, my name is Valerie Moyer. My kids have dinner with Valerie tonight at she got stuck on an airline. But I just wanted to say that I appreciate what David was saying about things that we gain when we get older. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more, if you could talk more about that. And I just have to say that I went into teaching cooking and cleaning, you know. I had a similar publishing history to Valerie. But I actually have learned so much in my teaching, right? They expect that you and I remember in my head when I'm writing and I'm doing something I told in the class I shouldn't do, that I shouldn't do that either. So I'm just wondering, I mean, it's downplaying teaching, and I don't want to sound like Mary Poppins, but doesn't anything like teaching really anything
No, okay, again, it's a complicated process that happened because a lot of young writers or writers who got into teaching, there was an adaption process where I think the more they did it, the better they got at it, and two, it became much more a part of their own lives, the interaction with students. I started the creative writing program at Notre Dame, the graduate one, because I wanted to teach graduate students. And Notre Dame had a long history of teaching at creative writing to undergraduates, and they had actual writers on their staff, only a couple, one poet, one fiction writer. But the desire to teach graduate students is what prompted me to, you know, start the program. So there is that interaction, but I think for some writers, the nurturing effect of students, where they nurture you, works quite well. For other kinds of writers, there's a more tension between, you know, that it's more a kind of parental sacrifice, that you're giving up a lot of your own time in order to instruct the young. And not to say that it's all in loco parentis that's going on, but there is a kind of, just that kind of tension, and some people profit more than others.
I'm, again, the anomaly here, because I teach adults at the Institute of Arts in Kellen, too. But this time last year, I was teaching the graduate poetry workshop at Notre Dame, so I was able to compare teaching 24-year-olds to adults. And I think that it's liable to disillusion you about the glories of being young and how much harder it is as you get older. Trying to be a writer, having the burning desire to be a writer and you feel like you've got all the material. But teaching adults who maybe have fewer chops, but adults are more willing to experiment, adults are more willing to be wounded. I had brilliant students, and three or four of them are actually, they're going to be big stuff. One of them was in the room to start with, and he's gone. But so many of them, there's a big experimental meaning at Notre Dame, and they were all brilliant, and so much of the writing was being done between their eyebrows and the top of their head, so that seeing adults who are brave enough to try doing something they're not good at, and seeing kids who are really good but haven't got the material that makes you braver in your own writing.
Yes.
I feel like I am part of a much smaller but growing singularity within the singularity we're speaking of here. I'm a new writer, over 60.
Okay.
How many of you in here consider yourself a new old writer? Okay?
You're a good one.
And I consider myself very fortunate. Okay? I've had two previous careers. I went back and got my poetry MFA in 2008 because I've been a reader all my life. I was sparked into poetry when I was 20 years old by a professor, and I chose other careers because I had to feed my family. And I've been very fortunate because since 2008, I've had two chapbooks published. I've won two chapbook awards. Currently, my four-inch manuscript is a finalist in a major contest. I've received some other poetry awards from some major publishers that you know. Okay? But here's my problem. When I fill out any application that I don't put my birthday down on, I think I'm on a level playing field. So when I put my birthday down on any fellowship application, any other kind of application, I feel as if, I'm being very candid, I feel like I can pick the winners by looking at their pictures, seeing how old they are, and seeing what major colleges and universities they're graduating from. And I feel, and I could be incorrect, but I feel that as long as I hide my birthday, I am on a level playing field. But I feel once someone discovers that I'm 64 years old, I feel that they don't want to invest the money in me for a fellowship or an opportunity, that they feel that they're not going to get their return in terms of 30 or 40 years of advertising for their major institution. Does anyone else feel that? And am I correct in any of my assumptions?
Yeah, I think you're pointing out any number of important things. One of them is that I think, you know, my powers of prediction aren't that good over my life, but in some ways I can't imagine the AWP and this sort of thing we're all part of becoming any larger. I think in some ways it must plateau. And when things plateau, then there's a reshifting of the tectonic plates.
Right.
And there is going to be another change, meaning in another 20 years, it isn't going to look like it looks now. And I think you're pointing out one of the things that's different, that the fact that some of the things that part, you know, lead us to still be writing, you know, better health care, you know, everything else, and the fact that you did have another career, so you, in some ways, finally subsidized your own desires to write, that kind of thing will happen more, and, you know, will make a difference. But you're right in terms of the oldest student we let into Notre Dame in the graduate program was 45. But the odd thing about,
I was 57.
Okay, 57. So, yeah, but she doesn't look 57. We don't request pictures. They used to when I went to Columbia. I had to put a photograph on the application. But the thing about it is, you're right in the sense of how much can we invest in this older student that plays a role. But the one I was thinking of who was 45, after he got his MFA, he hadn't ever, like David, had never had gotten a BA, but we sort of finagled him in. He went on to medical school and became a doctor. So,
That's fun.
Yeah,
no, I'm not saying that that is a disappointment, but I'm just saying that we participate in life of writers in any number of ways.
I remember many years ago, one question was, have you enjoyed teaching? And I remember when I first was hired at San Diego State, I was teaching what's called a creative nonfiction course, and it was a course in the art of the essay. And students come in from all kinds of backgrounds and aren't necessarily interested in creative writing as fiction writers, but they just want to experience writing at some level. And one of the students in that beginning course was a woman at that point who was 88 or 89 years old and had been a Hollywood player. She had obviously been an extraordinarily beautiful young woman, and at this point was still a very beautiful woman, but now quite old, obviously, and having trouble. And she wrote a series of essays on her aging body, and the kids loved it. Just loved it, especially the girls, because nobody tells anybody what's going to happen to you and what it may feel like. And it's very important. The poet Robert Duncan used to write letters to his friends about what it was like to be inside an aging body. And here was this wonderful woman writing these essays, and the kids loved it. And it was terrific. So, you know, I've enjoyed teaching. I've taught for 10 years. My first real teaching job was in maximum security prisons in New York State. And one of the things that I learned is that the whole foundation of the prison industrial complex was based on boys from my generation who came home ravaged and ill and went to prison. They couldn't stop their violence. Yes, you have a hand up back there. Naturally plateauing?
Yeah, this remark I made. As I say, it's the idea that you can't, because this generation, I'm going to be retiring soon, and any number of other people are going to be retiring soon, we're going to plateau out of academia, that the newer generations will have more effects on what happens. And as this gentleman pointed out, there will be pressure from above, too, which will change the nature of writing and more. And if the universities ever have a application problem, again, then they will be taking the non-regular sort of students, you know, happily and merrily. And that's the low residency MFA business is part of that process already. That's one of the adjustments that's been made for the student who wants to be in a creative writing program but can't leave their job, or doesn't want to become a student at a big university, any of that sort of thing. And I can't tell you how many published writers, I can tell you it's only been about six published writers who would write me
And I'm thinking, would you take me, you know, they published two or three books, would you, because you need an MFA to teach. And I kept, you know, kept writing them back saying, go to a low residency one. The administrators don't know the difference. Just get a MFA, and that will ease their, and if they're willing to hire, you know, you run into all the same kinds of stereotypes and prejudices and biases that are out there anyway. They want to know what kind of publications you have. And again, if you are an older age, if your publications or you haven't won awards, then they're going to be more chary of moving on. Yes, in the back.
Again, I don't know if it's a new trend, but in the history of literature, Edward Dahlberg, who was one of the writers I knew as a young person, he published his masterpiece when he was 64, because that was Flesh. So it happens that writers do ripen, writers do their best work at the, you know, later years. The thing about the young editor, I think it's just that publishing is still going through. I mean, Norton is one of the few independent houses that publishes literary fiction. It's going through such upheavals now that who knows? There might be more of what you were saying rather than less. But it's things are going to change because they always do. And but at the same time, you know, some things. You know, it's the cliche. Some things are going to change, other things are not going to change.
I remember when I first moved to New York, I was befriended by a number of artists, and many of whom were much older than I was at that point, really much older. And I remember one of those artists told me a long time ago, as he himself was beginning to move toward the problem posed by old age, that painting and the making of art are an old man and an old woman's game. That the art gains in its depth, gains in its presence, and gains in its imagination.
I don't want to say something that sounds ominous, but we've run out of time.
Excellent.
on everybody. Excellent.
I'm Terry Rickenbacker.
I'm Terry Rickenbacker.
Thank you.